One of the most peculiar things about Stanley Kubrick's Shining, for me as a person who spends a lot of time thinking about, talking about art and movies and things, is that most movies that I talk about with people, hardly anyone I know has seen them. The Shining is a major exception. The Shining is a film that it seems like everyone has seen. I don't think I've met anybody yet in the past couple weeks that I've asked who said, no, I've never seen it. No, I don't know anything about that. Everybody's seen The Shining. Now, what is it that they've seen? Well, all right, how about this? There's so many ways to discuss this and think about it. Well, no, let's do this. The Shining, it's available in several different versions, and the first version of it was Stephen King's book. Now, I have an unusual experience there, different probably from most of you. In 1978, I was working in a bookstore in San Francisco. The year before, I had seen Brian De Palma's movie of Carrie at an Army base movie theater in Merced, California, when I went to visit a friend there. And then a couple months later, I was on the road giving hearing tests across the country to make some money. And in some town, I think Michigan maybe, at a nearby bookstore, I picked up a copy of Stephen King's Carrie. I'd seen the movie, but I wanted to read the book, so that was the first Stephen King novel that I read. So in spring of 1979, I'm working at this bookstore on Market Street in San Francisco, and the new Stephen King book, The Shining, comes out. So I buy it or steal it or whatever it is that I did. And so I started reading it. And I think I got like the first 100 pages or something in the first day. And I was riding a bus. I think I was going over the bay between Berkeley and San Francisco with the book with me. And then I noticed for the first time, I hadn't seen it, a blurb on the back cover of the book that this was going to be a new film by Stanley Kubrick starring Jack Nicholson. So this was like double exciting. Young man, I was in my, I think I was 24, 25, probably. And I was excited about everything in art. And here was one of my favorite filmmakers and one of my favorite actors. And I was turning on to this book. So let me play for you the source of the title of the book, The Shining. Stephen King heard this on the radio, and there's a line in it that he picked up on.
Get yourself together, darling.
The music here is Béla Bartók and music for strings, percussion, and celesta. It plays throughout The Shining. Stephen King famously did not like Stanley Kubrick's movie, and he had problems with it from way in the beginning. Now, apparently, when he was first contacted by Kubrick, he was very excited by the idea of Kubrick doing the film, because even, you know, King had to recognize Kubrick. But he ultimately didn't like the film because, you know, King had his own reasons, but for, you know, what he was doing when he wrote the book. And, you know, it hasn't taken anything away from the book because it's a completely separate thing, a film experience. But let's remind ourselves of that King didn't like it. King tells the story of how he was hungover and the baby was screaming and he was taking a shower or he was shaving himself. And his wife yells that Stanley Kubrick's on the phone. And so he wipes off his face and he picks up the phone. And the first thing that Stanley Kubrick says to him is, "I think stories of the paranormal are optimistic, basically. Don't you think that?" King has always thought that was so weird on Kubrick's part. And then King didn't want Jack Nicholson to play Jack Torrance in the film because, I think he didn't start saying this until many years later, but I think he associated, you know, Cuckoo's Nest with Nicholson, where, you know, he won the Oscar and all that. And he, that performance is so iconic that he was sure that that would blend in. And, well, playing Jack in The Shining is, I think, the other totally iconic performance by Jack Nicholson. And then King made his own version of The Shining for television in 1997. But Kubrick forbid him from selling it as a video at the time that he made the TV film. He produced it and wrote the screenplay because Kubrick didn't want there to be any alternate videos to interfere with his film, The Shining. So King wasn't happy about that either, but only 2 years later, Stanley Kubrick died. And so King got to release it to video. I've got it on videotape at home. And, it, you know, it's nice. I mean, I'd read the book, so it's nice to get a nice version of the book. I like Steven Weber and Rebecca De Mornay in it and all that. But, hey, it ain't The Shining. It's not. It doesn't have anywhere the effect. And in fact, one of the key things was that Kubrick used a hedge maze and the image of the labyrinth in place of the topiary animals in King's book. And seeing the topiary animals brought to CGI life in this TV movie version didn't work. It wasn't scary. It wasn't funny, but it wasn't scary. And actually, it was kind of, So King got to make his version. I hope he was happy about that, because the important one is the film that Stanley Kubrick made. Kubrick called the movie a masterpiece of modern horror. Now, here's another odd thing about The Shining. Whereas most of Stanley Kubrick's movies, after he reached a successful peak in his career, most of them won Oscars and Golden Globes and awards and all that, but not The Shining. The Shining only won Razzies for worst performances. Shelley Duvall got one for her performance as Wendy, and I think Jack was nominated. Oh, and the film just got terrible reviews on its opening. I was in Chicago in June 1980 when the film was released. I was directing the play Family Snapshot for the Remains Theater with Gary Cole and those people. And so it was a Friday. I went to the opening showing in Chicago downtown. And I guess my first impression, I guess I wasn't impressed, or I was impressed by some of it, but some of it I had a hard time with, you know. And I do get hard times with narrative inconveniences and things. So it took a few viewings. I think the next time I saw it was winter time, and I was at my friend Leonard Robinson. He's a Facebook friend. He had been a roommate back in college. I was visiting him, and The Shining was on HBO or something at that time, and I watched it again. And, you know, it was already gnawing at me by that point. It was such a peculiar film. You know, another thing that King would say about Kubrick is that he was a cold, cold man, you know, and he thought too much, to which most of us will reply, you know, King should probably think some more and not be so feeling. But I don't think that's really true of Stanley Kubrick. I mean, he was a smoker. He was an ordinary guy. It's just that because he wouldn't do interviews and because he was so meticulous about his films, that he created an aura about himself that made him seem standoffish and hard to understand. But actually, he cared a lot. He was deeply hurt by the fact that Barry Lyndon was a box office bomb. It did not make its money back. I mean, the thing about Kubrick's movies is they really do have legs. So that just because Barry Lyndon was not initially a success, when it was reissued the next year, it started making more money. His films over time would grow. Kubrick didn't do anything that I know of with Barry Lyndon when it wasn't successful on its initial run. But he had a definite response when The Shining opened to bad reviews and poorer box office than he expected. First thing he did is the original film, the ones that first were shown. And by the way, another thing about The Shining is that it rolled out. It didn't open in 3,000 theaters at once. It opened in two or three theaters and then began to spread slowly. It took time to get around because they could do that in those days. So by the time I saw it, it was the 144-minute version. The initial film was 146 minutes, and it had a scene at the end of the film where Ullman, the guy who gives Jack the job, goes to see Wendy and Danny in the hospital. So there's a happy ending or whatever, a conclusion that was on the initial film. And the immediate response shortly after the film opened, I guess after a couple days of showing, is Kubrick had that two-minute sequence removed from the film. Then, over the next couple of weeks, he began to pare the film down immensely to the point where the film that he released, if it had started at 146 minutes, he cut it down to about 110 minutes. He cut over 30 minutes out of the film. And that is the version that was shown in Europe and Asia back then. And that is the version known as the international cut. And if you see the film, the American version, you remember Ann Jackson is in it playing a doctor who looks after Danny when he loses consciousness. He faints. None of that is in the international cut. In fact, he pared down almost all explanation scenes so that the film is super, you know, it's tight and shorter. It's not even 2 hours long. But the thing is, that's the version that most of the world has seen. Now, apparently in the last 10 years, through the magic of DVDs, the world is starting to get more and more of these, of the uncut version. And in fact, I've never seen the international cut. The version I'm going to use tonight is the 144-minute version, which is the same one that I saw in the movie theater. Now, why am I interested? Well, Alan Keough and I went to the Stanley Kubrick exhibit at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art 2 weeks ago. And that was exciting, but it also made me start going online and looking around and discovering all of the mad conspiracy theories about Kubrick's work that have collected. It's reached the point where there's actually a movie about to be released about the mad interpretations of the movie The Shining. It's called Room 237, which is the room where Jack sees the woman, you know, in the bathtub. As Scatman Crothers, as Halloran, says, there ain't nothing in Room 237. So, the film is not available yet. It has been playing the festival circuit. But I did find an interview with the filmmakers, and they touch on several of the themes that come up. So I'm going to play that now, because I want you to start thinking about the broader impression of things in terms of what is themes. And I'm already rushing it. I'm sorry. I'm talking too fast. I mean, I really need to slow down.
And, you know, Kubrick's involvement with it.
Yeah. You know, certainly, like 237, even the number 237. In the book, you know, it was 217. So people, you know, as they compare the book and the movie, anything they see changed, and oh my God, almost everything has been changed. But everything must have been changed, you know, for a reason. And if something as simple as a number has changed, then there has to be a lot behind it.
Well, you know what Kubrick says about the change, though, of the room number.
Yeah, I do, though I'm maybe not the only person who's skeptical about that.
I know. I understand. Yes. You know, but just for the benefit of our audience that might not know, Kubrick said that room 217 was used in the book. The actual hotel that they based their hotel on in the film didn't want to be bombarded with people wanting 217, so they used a room number that does not exist in the hotel, room 237. Am I right about that?
No, that's what I've heard too, and that may be exactly what happened. But I mean, Kubrick is also someone who's, you know, notoriously
cryptic. Yeah.
Cryptic, and if the number had a lot of meaning, he would never come right out and say it. So
no, I agree with you. Yeah.
Yeah, and especially when you're talking about The Shining, then your mind does go to mysteries and hidden meanings and keys to puzzles. And so 237, you know, is definitely one of those that that pops up in many of the theories that we've looked at.
Now, we just rewatched the film about a week ago, and the scene of Jack in 237 in particular is kind of confusing, but just what's happening.
The thing we were struck with the sequence was that it begins with Halloran sort of channeling what's going on with Danny, and we see Danny shaking in a room, and then we see sort of Danny's perspective of what's happening in 237, and suddenly it's
literally a point of view shot. So he's viewing it through Jack's eyes. And the way things is cut is really confusing. And confusing, I think, in a really fascinating way that sticks with you, because you see him, you know, he has the encounter with the young woman and then the old woman, but right after, you know, the young woman is turned into that hag, sort of continuity is broken, and we cut to her, like, sinking into the tub.
Mm-hmm.
So that, like, it's a big jump cut, and the question is that a vision of her drowning, you know, so many years ago back in the hotel, or is that what Danny saw, when he walked into the room earlier? So with just one, you know, simple cut from the two shot of Jack and the woman in the bathroom to her in the tub, time is confused and fractured, and whose point of view we're seeing what from becomes very mysterious and enigmatic really, really quickly.
Have you heard any takes on what the young / old woman means? Yes.
Oh, we've read a few. You know, we're just moving right now from our research into our interviews, so we don't have a ton of them laid down. Mm-hmm. But certainly, there's the idea from the book where, that character actually had a name, and I think she had committed suicide in the bathtub.
Mm-hmm.
Tim, do you remember what some of the ideas about the young woman in the hag were?
I know there's some Gemini duality theory out there. I'm actually looking through my notes right now, trying to see if I could find.
And Kubrick was actually obsessed with themes of duality.
Say in The Shining, in particular, there's so many characters are doubled. There's so many doppelgangers from, Jack in the present day to Jack in the photo, to Grady's, Delbert and Charles, the twin sisters. And there are theories that connect actually Danny and the mother to the twin girls. There was this amazing diagram somebody drew of a shot of the back of Danny on the big wheel and how much it looked like one of the dresses that the girls wear. That there are characters linked. And gosh, so many of the scenes are shot through mirrors.
Right. Right. And how in the scene with Grady in the bathroom, how they're not quite, obviously they're surrounded by mirrors and they're not quite looking at each other.
And there's an interesting jump cut in the bathroom scene that's been remarked upon where, it's kind of on one shot we see, it's a profile shot and we see Jack and Grady facing each other. And then maybe what's not super unusual for Kubrick, but it's kind of a weird cut from other people's standards, is like the 180 flip where the camera is on the other side of the room. Mm-hmm. So Jack and Grady literally change places. Mm. And as they talk about, you're the caretaker, no, you're the caretaker, was kind of fascinating because their screen position switches.
God, I love this movie. Seriously, I do. Let's talk about one theory that we've discussed with Bill Blakemore, and you guys have obviously had correspondence with him on this as well. And it's obvious that the film has a streak of that character has a streak of racism in it. He's obviously commenting or portraying racism on some level. But Mr. Blakemore's theory, and I've heard others echo this, is the idea that the film is actually about the genocide of the American Indian. Is this something that you guys are exploring and finding more and more examples of?
Oh, well, absolutely. Bill is, a major person, that we're speaking to in the film. And God, his insight into the film is pretty amazing. Tim?
The amazing thing about Bill's theory is that he wrote this in 1987, and people are still discussing it. And watching the film with Rodney just the other night, it's the first time I've actually revisited it since we started talking with Bill, and it was really difficult not to see a lot of the themes that he's talking about in the film. Though they had not jumped out at me initially. So, when I first read his article, I did immediately flash to the business where Ullman's showing Wendy and Danny around and talking about the Indian, there may have been an Indian uprising while they were building the overlook. Yeah, it is. It's a really interesting theory, and I imagine you guys had a very good conversation about it.
Well, and it extends into the marketing of the film as well, as Mr. Blakemore discussed. Even the tagline on the poster, the wave of terror that swept across the nation is here. The poster that was released, months before the actual movie
came
out. Yeah. And the U.S. gets a longer version. We got our own version.
Yeah. Well, and I love the way he talks about the music that plays, over the opening scene of the car driving through the mountains. and those mm-hmm. wails that you hear that, you know, always send shivers, you know, up the back of my spine.
Almost sound like Indian chants.
Yeah, well, that's what he. Yeah. I'd never heard that, but when he places it there, I can totally feel that, and especially in that, you know, great Western landscape. It's pretty powerful.
So, do you find that when you latch on to another theory, you find another theory, you kind of have to look at the movie with fresh eyes and in that frame of mind? Okay, I'm looking for this now. I mean, how many times have you guys revisited the movie, exploring these different themes?
We talk about this pretty much every time we talk, and noodle around it and come at it from different angles and throw questions at each other and try and make the, you know, meld some of these theories, which is just fascinating and endless, and I don't think we're alone in that. We've been corresponding with Bill, and I know you've been involved in Zemo exchanges as well, Jamie, where he and his friend Richard clearly spend a great deal of time, or when they do talk about it, they get real deep real fast.
I found that it's very surprising, because of all the movies that we're covering with Kubrick, I thought that 2001 would be the most cryptic and open for interpretation, or Eyes Wide Shut. And Eyes Wide Shut is proving to be a challenge to kind of decipher with some of these guests we've had, but none more so than The Shining. I mean, there are so many varying interpretations. Is it about the horrors of writer's block? Is it about the genocide? And this theory, I'm sure you guys have found it, it's one of the most popular and kind of joked about on the internet about The Shining, which is the faked Apollo moon landing theory of Jay Widener's.
No, I find his idea really fascinating. I think for me, there's a point when I read any of them, and they're sort of cumulative. And by the time somebody has a half a dozen or more correspondences, you know, between their reading and what's in the film, it starts to get a real weight and become more and more persuasive. Mm. And, you know, Jay, you know, like a lot of folks, has got a lot of little details in there that add
very
up.
Very specific examples that illustrate his points. Yeah, it's hard to argue once you read, because he's so specific about his explanation for Room 237 is the distance between the Earth and the Moon.
137,000 miles. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
and the rocket on his jersey, climbing up in the frame. You see, and that's another, and that's a theory that I think he only wrote it like less than a year ago, which for us is, you know, a real, really significant that this film that's 30, you know, years old now, is still being talked about and picked about, and, you know, it isn't that everything was said and done about it in the year after it was created. Like, I teach editing at a film school here in California, and it's interesting because I show the kids scenes from 2001, which is an incredibly important film to me, and they're not super into it. You know, and they say, oh, yeah, the bone turns into a spaceship, we get it. But they've all seen, and they're all fascinated by The Shining, you know, kids 19 to early 20s. That film has a real power with them.
Also, because I found that with The Shining, out of all of Kubrick's movies, it's the one that works the best strictly as a genre film. You can appreciate The Shining just as you would an exceptional horror movie on that same level. But then you realize that there's so many more deeper levels here. And I think that's what we're discovering as people get older. You know, I was so young when I first watched The Shining, and as the years pass and I revisit it, I'm more receptive to those ideas coming off the screen than I was when I first saw it. But knowing Kubrick, I think that all of the speculation is not a bunch of hot air, because he thrived on ambiguity. I mean, there are hidden messages in all of his films, I think.
Yeah, well, there are hidden messages, and ambiguity is a really key word. You know, that there are a lot of things that, you know, aren't fully explained in the film, you know, in the text of the film itself. When I saw The Sixth Sense, you know, the M. Night Shyamalan movie, which, you know, it's a pretty good little movie, but there was a point in it when we find out what the relationship of the ghost to the kid are, and you know, what the kid's mission is in relation to the ghost. And at that very instant, the movie is no longer scary or mysterious. I stick with it to the end, but the whole cloud, like the first section of that movie is actually very scary. But once that mystery is completely solved, you know, all of my tension left, you know, and I became a little bit less engaged.
Yes.
Whereas Kubrick never really answers the mystery in The Shining, which is, I think, part of the reason we keep returning to it, you know, now 30 years later.
Well, let me ask you this, Tim, because just this past weekend we spoke to Tony Frewen, Kubrick's assistant for many, many years, and I actually asked him, I said, you know, everyone has theories about what Kubrick's films meant, and he was very cagey about discussing them, and I'm thankful for that, because if he was explicit in his explanation of what these movies meant, then they wouldn't survive as long as they have, I don't think. But I said, are we all crazy? Are we making up stuff, or is it a bunch of hot air? And he said no. Kubrick loved the fact that people took these films into their hearts and minds, and it meant something personal for everyone. But did you ever think, Tim, that all these theories are a bunch of hot air, or did you always know that there was meat to them, there was something there?
To return to a point that Rodney made earlier, there's a tipping point for me when we come upon these theories where there's an accumulation of evidence or observations or whatever you want to call it that the authors have found in the film, where I go, whoa, maybe this is real. And I like hearing that Tony told you that, because it makes me smile to think that Kubrick was getting a chuckle or enjoying the fact that we're all sort of wandering in this maze of a film made, and as many people have pointed out, the maze is one of the central images of The Shining. Someone even pointed out that Kubrick's production company, at one time, not when he was making The Shining, was named Minotaur. And of course, the maze doesn't exist in the book. These topiary animals that came to life. So, you know, this is something that Kubrick intentionally brought to the film, and I would agree it's probably one of the central
Sigmund Freud's essay on the uncanny was important to Kubrick when he was making the film. Freud first talks about Hoffman's own theory, which he disagrees with, but then he goes on to identify uncanny effects that result from instances of what he calls repetition of the same thing, including incidents wherein one becomes lost and accidentally retraces one's steps. That's in the movie. And instances wherein random numbers recur seemingly meaningfully, which could also be things like the red rum that happens in the film. He discusses the concept of the double as an uncanny. Freud specifically relates an aspect of the uncanny derived from German etymology by contrasting the German adjective unheimlich with its base word heimlich, concealed, hidden, in secret. He proposes that social taboo often yields an aura not only of pious reverence, but even more so of horror and even disgust. as the taboo state of an item gives rise to the commonplace assumption that that which is hidden from public eye, the eye or sight metaphor, must be a dangerous threat and even an abomination, especially if the concealed item is obviously or presumingly sexual in nature. Basically, the uncanny is what is unconsciously, or is what unconsciously reminds us of our own id, our forbidden and thus repressed impulses perceived as a threatening force by our superego ridden with Oedipal guilt as it fears symbolic castration by punishment for deviating from societal norms. You know what? I think that's a lot more, makes a lot more sense than you know, this old lady means something other than a ghost which turns into a hag in Jack's arms. But even there, the nudity and the sexuality, that is disgusting and appealing. It draws you and repels you in equal measures. The film is full of this and other uncanny effects. Now, let's mention briefly, because we're about to start, we have to get into this. And what I'm going to do, I know it's a visual medium film, but it's also an audio medium. And we're going to listen to The Shining. And we're going to see what happens just by listening to it. And by the way, what I'm playing is not the DVD. It's my own transfer of an original videotape to DVD. So it even has, it's not even that high quality a version of it, but it's everything there, you know? I just think that makes a difference too. It's a bootleg. It's a bootleg version of The Shining. So let's see. For instance, this is the kind of thing that Kubrick does in the film, which, think about it. What does it mean? In the opening sequence, there are shots from a helicopter, obviously from a helicopter, watching a car driving through the Rocky Mountains. And at one point in the lower right-hand corner of the screen, you see the shadow of the helicopter. It just pops in for a couple frames and goes out. Was that a mistake? Was that meant to be there? When Kubrick worked with the film, I mean, there's a coming on the DVD, and you can find it on YouTube. There is a film called The Making of The Shining, and it actually comes as a bonus on the DVD currently. And The Making of The Shining was shot by Stanley Kubrick's daughter, Vivian. She was 17 years old. So it's her following Jack Nicholson and Shelley Duvall, doing little interviews with the people, following them around, watching her dad shoot the film. And there's a lot there. The scene where Jack is locked in the cupboard, Kubrick's lying on the floor, shooting up, you know, with just a little camera looking straight up at him. So it's very personal, and you can see how close things are. Shelley Duvall had a really hard time with the film, and Kubrick seems to be kind of rude to her in the film, not mean, and she just has a really hard time getting, and he keeps going, you know, going up to her and saying, at one sequence she doesn't come out on cue, and he goes up and says, "Shelley, we have a lot of people waiting here, why didn't you come out?" And like gets on her case about it, and I know he would never have done that to Jack Nicholson. There's no way he'd do that to Nicholson. Now, Duvall says that she was jealous of the treatment that Nicholson got on the set. At the end of the film, she says, "I think he was right to treat me this way."
It made
the performance that he wanted and makes her interesting. She's kind of a cartoon. Basically, he took multiple takes of everything. The sequence of Danny and Scatman Crothers sitting at the table... Uh-huh. That one camera was just on Scatman. They did 149 takes. 7 minutes long, 149 times. And Kubrick printed every one. and watched them all. The scene of on the stairway where she's got the baseball bat with Jack, it was done like 60, 70 times, you know? So what do you get when you do that? Well, there's a scene in the film where Jack is typing and Wendy comes in and interrupts him. And he tells her, you know, whenever you hear me typing or you know I'm in here, you know I'm working, and so don't bother me. But there's a shot where Wendy is in the far left of the screen and Jack sitting at the table with the typewriter is sitting on the right. And between him, you can see the wall behind them. This shot happens three times. I think the way it goes, the first time you see it, in between them, sitting against the wall, is a chair. It's a visible chair. The next two times the shot happens, the chair isn't there. Now, why would he do that? I mean, he's so meticulous. I know this sounds dumb, but that had to be on purpose. That wasn't a continuity error. Or was it? So with that, and I'll talk a few times. I might even play a little music. I don't know if I want to play all of the long dialogue sequences, but maybe I do. Anyway, folks, we're deep in the labyrinth. Welcome to the chill room. Volkswagen go. And the credits roll, a Stanley Kubrick film. Now you're about to hear voices on the soundtrack, sounds on the soundtrack. They were talking about these are Indian sounds in the interview I played before. There's no hedge maze.
I never thought of that.
Now Jack is entering. We see the motif, the Indian motifs and things across the hall.
I've got an appointment with Mr. Allman. My name's Jack Torrance.
His office is the first door on the left.
Thank you.
Now I'm going to stop the film for a second. There's a thing you can find on YouTube called the Schoen Report, which is about a series of audio markers that appear in The Shining, which they claim to be Stanley Kubrick's voice, and they claim that they have some kind of significance. Now, the thing is, the markers or the sound is definitely there. Here it is. As he... Listen now. Did you hear that?
I can't hear it at all.
I'm going to go back a little bit.
You got the monitor on.
Oh. Now, you heard it that time, right? That happened 16 times in the first 48 minutes of the movie. Another one happens shortly.
Yeah. I'm Jack Torrance.
Oh, well, come on in, Jack.
Okay, here's another thing. As we go into Ullman's office, in the background there is a window, and you can see trees and sunlight through it. The window is impossible. When you walk out of the office and go around the corner, there's a hallway behind it. So the window is impossible.
Very nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, Mr. Ullman.
This is my secretary, Susie.
Hello.
Susie, how do you do?
Have any trouble finding us?
Oh, no problem.
Now, here's this expositional dialogue.
That's very good time.
That has no meaning. It's just meaningless chatter.
Make yourself at home. Would you like some coffee?
Well, if you're going to have some, I wouldn't mind. Thanks.
Susie?
Sure.
Oh, and would you ask Bill Watson to join us?
Yes, I will.
And now we're going back to the... We're going down to Denver.
Mom?
Yeah?
He really won't go and live in that hotel for the winter.
Watching a Bugs Bunny cartoon or Meet
Me.
Roadrunner.
It'll be lots of fun.
Yeah, I guess so. In a way, there's hardly anybody to play with around here.
Yeah, I know. It always takes a little time to make new friends.
Yeah, I guess so.
What about Tony? He's looking forward to the hotel, I bet.
All right, Mr. Torrance.
Now, come on, Tony. Don't be silly.
I don't want to go there, Mrs. Torrance.
Well, how come you don't want to go?
I just don't.
Well, let's just wait and see. We're all going to have a real good time.
Bill, I'd like you to meet Jack Torrance.
How do you do?
Bill, how do you do?
Nice to meet you.
Pleasure to meet you. Grab a chair. Bill, join in. Jack is going to take care of the Overlook for us this winter. I'd like you to take him around the place soon as we're through.
Fine.
Jack is a school teacher.
Formerly a school teacher.
What line of work are you in now?
I'm a writer. Teaching's been more or less a way of making ends meet.
Well, this ought to be quite a change for you.
Well, I'm looking for a change.
Our people in Denver recommended Jack very highly, and for once, I agree with them. Let's see, where were we? I was, about to explain that our season here runs from May 15th to October 30th. Then we close down completely until the following May.
Do you mind if I ask why you do that? It seems to me that the skiing up here would be fantastic.
There was just another show.
Be. The problem is the enormous cost it would be to keep the road to Sidewinder open. It's a 25-mile stretch of road. It gets an average of 20 feet of snow during the winter, and there's no way to make it economically feasible to keep it clear. When the place was built in 1907, there was very little interest in winter sports, and this site was chosen for its seclusion and scenic beauty.
Well, it's certainly got plenty of that.
That's right. Did they give you any idea in Denver about what the job entails?
Only in a very general way.
Well, the winters can be fantastically cruel. And the basic idea is to cope with the very costly damage and depreciation which can occur. And this consists mainly of running the boiler, heating different parts of the hotel on a daily rotating basis, repairing damage as it occurs, and doing repairs so that the elements can't get a foothold.
Well, that sounds fine to me.
Physically, it's not a very demanding job. The only thing that can get a bit trying up here during the winter is the tremendous sense of isolation.
Well, that just happens to be exactly what I'm looking for. I'm outlining a new writing project, and 5 months of peace is just what I want.
That's very good, Jack. Because for some people, solitude and isolation can of itself become a problem.
Not for me.
How about your wife and son? How do you think they'll take to it?
They'll love it.
Right. Well, before I turn you over to Bill, there's one other thing I think we should talk about. I don't want to sound melodramatic, but it's something that's been known to give a few people second thoughts about the job.
I'm intrigued.
I don't suppose they told you anything in Denver about the tragedy we had up here during the winter of 1970?
I don't believe they did.
Well, my predecessor in this job hired a man named Charles Grady as the winter caretaker. And he came up here with his wife and two little girls, I think about 8 and 10. And he had a good employment record, good references. And from what I've been told, I mean, he seemed like a completely normal individual. But at some point during the winter, he must have suffered some kind of a complete mental breakdown. He ran amok and killed his family with an axe. Stacked them neatly in one of the rooms of the West Wing, and then he put both barrels of a shotgun in his mouth. Police, they thought that it was what the old-timers used to call cabin fever, a kind of claustrophobic reaction which can occur when people are shut in together over long periods of time.
Well, that is quite a story.
Yeah, it is. Oh, it's still hard for me to believe it actually happened here. But it did. And I think you can appreciate why I wanted to tell you about it.
I certainly can, and I also understand why your people in Denver left it for you to tell me.
Well, obviously, I mean, some people can be put off by the idea of staying alone at a place where something like that actually happened.
Well, you can rest assured, Mr. Ullman, that's not going to happen with me. And as far as my wife is concerned, I'm sure she'll be absolutely fascinated when I tell her about it. She's a confirmed ghost story and horror film addict.
Okay, now we have a scene of Danny and Tony. So let me state there that some peculiarities. For instance, he's Ullman referred to Charles Grady and his wife and two daughters, 8 and 10. But later in the film, when Jack meets Grady, the butler, his name is Delbert Grady. And Danny sees twin girls, not 8 and 10, but twin girls in the hallways. So, is that a mistake? Of course not. But it is uncanny because it is normal.
Tony, why don't you want to go to a hotel? I don't want know. You do too, no. No, come on, tell me. I don't want to.
Please. No. Now, Kubrick initially wanted the boy from Close Encounters of the Third Kind to play Danny, but when his parents read the script, that child was not allowed to do the film. So they had a long casting call, Leon Battali, who played Mord Bullington, the older version of the son in Barry Lyndon, was actually the guy who went out and did the casting in the States for Kubrick and found Danny Lloyd, who's from Pekin, Illinois, which is real near my hometown. So let's take a moment and go through some cold rain and snow with the Grateful Dead.
Yeah.
This is a piece of music by Wendy Carlos called Rocky Mountain.
Boy, we must really be high up. The air feels so different.
Mm-hmm.
Dad?
Yes?
I'm hungry.
Well, you should have eaten your breakfast.
We'll get you something as soon as we get to the hotel, okay?
Okay, Mom.
Hey, wasn't it around here that the Donner Party got snowbound?
I think that was farther west in the Sierras.
What was the Donner Party?
They were a party of settlers in covered wagon times. They got snowbound one winter in the mountains. They had to resort to cannibalism in order to stay alive.
You mean they ate each other up?
They had to, in order to survive.
Jack.
Don't worry, Mom. I know all about cannibalism. I saw it on TV.
See? It's okay. He saw it on the television.
One of my favorite aspects of this section of the film, which is the people are cleaning up the hotel as they move out, is all the sounds in the background.
Good morning, Jack.
So I'm going to just play this without talking.
No problem. In fact, we had time to grab a bite to eat.
Good. Glad you made it before they shut down the kitchen. Is your family having a look around?
No, my son's discovered the game is wrong.
Oh. Has your luggage been brought in?
Right there.
Oh, fine. Well, in view of all the ground we have to cover today, I suggest we go have a quick look at your apartment and then get started straight away. Bill, would you have the Torrances' things brought to their apartments?
Fine. I better collect my family first.
Oh. This is our Colorado lounge.
Oh, it's beautiful. My God. This place is fantastic, isn't it, hon?
Sure is.
God, I've never seen anything like this before. Are all these Indian designs authentic?
Yeah, I believe based mainly on Navajo and Apache motifs.
Oh, well, they're really gorgeous. As a matter of fact, this is probably the most gorgeous hotel I've ever seen.
Oh, this old place has had an illustrious past. In its heyday, it was one of the stopping places for the jet set, even before anybody knew what a jet set was. We had four presidents who stayed here. Lots of movie stars.
Royalty?
All the best people.
Wing of the hotel. None of the other bedrooms are heated during the winter.
Oh, goodbye, Mr. Allman.
Goodbye, girls. And here are your quarters. Living room, bedroom, bathroom, and a small bedroom for your son.
Perfect for a child.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, the place is very nicely self-contained. Easy to keep.
cozy.
Yes, very cozy for a family. And if you feel like spreading out, you have the rest of the hotel to move around in.
Well, it's very, homey.
Yeah.
This is our famous hedge maze. It's quite an attraction around here. The walls are 13 feet high, and the hedge is about as old as the hotel itself. It's a lot of fun, but I wouldn't want to go in there unless I had an hour to spare to find my way out.
When was the overlook built?
Construction started in 1907. It's finished in 1909. The site is supposed to be located on an Indian burial ground, and I believe they actually had to repel a few Indian attacks as they were building it. That's our snow cat. Can you both drive a car?
Yes.
Yeah. That's fine. Because basically, the snow cat operates very much like a car, and it won't take you long to get the hang of it. As a matter of fact, we brought a decorator in from Chicago just last year to refurbish this part of the hotel.
Oh, well, he sure did a beautiful job. Pink and gold are my favorite colors.
Oh, well, this is our gold ballroom.
Oh, I'll say.
We can accommodate up to 300 people here very comfortably.
Boy, I bet you we could really have a good party in this room, huh, hon?
I'm afraid you're not going to do too well here unless you brought your own supplies. We always remove all the booze from the premises when we shut down. That reduces the insurance we normally have to carry.
We don't drink.
Well, then you're in luck. Oh, Dick, come on over and say hello to Mr. and Mrs. Torrance.
Sure.
This is Dick Halloran, our head chef.
Mr. Halloran, I'm Jack.
Glad to meet you, Jack.
This is my wife, Winifred.
Glad to meet you, Winifred.
Nice to meet you.
The Torrances are going to take care of the overlook for us this winter.
Oh, that's just great. How do you folks like our hotel so far?
Oh, it's just wonderful. Hi, Danny.
I found him outside looking for you.
Dan, did you get tired of bombing the universe?
Yeah. Come on over here. Thanks.
Thank you, Susie. Dick, if you're ready to do it now, I think it'd be a good idea if you could show Mrs. Torrance the kitchen while I continue on with Jack.
It'd be a pleasure. Right this way, Mrs. Torrance.
Great. See you later, hon.
Bye, darling.
Mrs. Torrance, your husband introduced you as Winifred. Now, are you a Winnie or a Freddy?
I'm a Wendy.
Oh, Wendy. That's nice. That's the prettiest.
God, this is the kitchen, huh?
Yeah, this is it. How do you like it, Danny? Is it big enough for you?
Yeah. It's the best place I've ever seen.
Yeah, this whole place is such an enormous maze. I feel like I'll have to leave a trail of breadcrumbs every time I come in.
Don't let it get you down, Mrs. Torrance. It's big, but it still ain't nothing but a kitchen. And a lot of this stuff you'll never have to touch.
I wouldn't know what to do with it if I did.
Well, one thing for sure, you don't have to worry about food. Because you folks would eat up here a whole year and never have the same menu twice. Now, right here is our walk-in freezer. Now, this is where we keep all of our meat. You got 15 rib roasts, 30 10-pound bags of hamburger. We got 12 turkeys, about 40 chickens, 50 sirloin steaks, 2 dozen of pork roasts, and 20 legs of lamb. You like lamb, Doc?
No.
You don't? Well, what's your favorite food, then?
French fries and ketchup.
Well, I think we can manage that, too, Doc. Come along now. Watch your step.
Mr. Halloran, how do you know we call him Doc?
Beg pardon?
Doc. You called Danny Doc twice just now.
I did?
Yeah. We call him Doc sometimes, you know, like in the Bugs Bunny cartoons. But how did you know that?
Well, I guess I probably heard you call him that.
Well, it's possible, but I honestly don't remember calling him that since we've been with you.
Well, anyway, he looks like a Doc, doesn't he?
Yeah. What's up, Doc?
Now, this is the storeroom. In here, Mrs. Torrance, is where we keep all the dry goods and the canned goods. We got canned fruits and vegetables, canned fish and meats, hot and cold cereals, post toasters, corn flakes, sugar puffs, Rice Krispies, oatmeal, wheat thin and cream of wheat. You got a dozen jugs of black molasses. We got 60 boxes of dried milk, 32-pound bags of sugar.
How'd you like some ice cream, Doc?
cinnamon rolls, and seven kinds of what have you. Now we got dried peaches, dried apricots, dried raisins, and dried prunes. You know, Mrs. Torrance, you gotta keep regular if you want to be happy. Hi.
Hi.
How are you getting on?
Just fine.
Dick, can we borrow Mrs. Torrance for a few minutes? We're on our way through to the basement. I promise we won't keep her very long. No problem, Mr. Urban. I was just getting to the ice cream. You like ice cream, Doc?
Yeah.
I thought you did. You folks don't mind if I give Danny some ice cream while I'm waiting for you?
Not at all.
No, we don't mind.
Good.
Sound good to you, Doc?
Yeah.
Okay, you behave yourself.
Now, what kind of ice cream do you like, Doc?
Chocolate.
Chocolate it shall be. Come on, son.
It's amazing how much activity's going on today.
Yes, well, the guests and some of the staff left yesterday, but the last day's always very hectic. Everybody wants to be on their way as early as possible. By 5 o'clock tonight, you'll never know anybody was ever here.
Just like a ghost ship, huh?
Yes.
Do you know how I knew your name was Doc? You know what I'm talking about, don't you? I can remember when I was a little boy, my grandmother and I could hold conversations entirely without ever opening our mouths. She called it shining. And for a long time, I thought it was just the two of us that had the shine to us. Just like you probably thought you was the only one. But there are other folks, though mostly they don't know it or don't believe it. How long have you been able to do it? Why don't you want to talk about it?
I'm not supposed to.
Who says you ain't supposed to?
Tony.
Who's Tony?
Tony's the little boy that loves my mouth.
Is Tony the one that tells you things?
Yes.
How does he tell you things?
It's like I go to sleep and he shows me things. But when I wake up, I can't remember everything.
Does your mom and dad know about Tony?
Yes.
Do they know he tells you things?
No, Tony told me never to tell him.
Has Tony ever told you anything about this place? About the Overlook Hotel?
I don't know.
Now think real hard, Doc. Think.
Maybe he showed me something.
Try to think of what it was.
Drowling, are you scared of this place?
No. Scared of nothing here. It's just that, you know, some places are like people. Some shine and some don't. I guess you could say the Overlook Hotel here has something about it that's like shining.
Is there something bad here?
Well, you know, Doc, when something happens, it can leave a trace of itself behind. Say, like, if someone burns toast. Well, maybe things that happen leave other kind of traces behind. Not things that anyone can notice, but things that people who shine can see. Just like they can see things that haven't happened yet. Well, sometimes they can see things that happened a long time ago. I think a lot of things happened right here in this particular hotel over the years. And not all of them was good.
What about room 237?
Room 237?
You're scared of room 237, ain't you?
No, I ain't.
Mr. Allen, what is in room 237?
Nothing. There ain't nothing in room 237. But you ain't got no business going in there anyway. So stay out. You understand? Stay out.
A month later. That's by a great Grigori Leggetti. It's called Lontano. It's the music that's playing here. Danny on the Big Wheel is some of my favorite stuff. This reminds me of Michael Snow.
Good morning, hon. Your breakfast is ready.
What time is it?
It's about 11:30.
11:30? Jesus.
I guess you've been staying up too late.
I know it.
I made them just the way you like them, sunny side up.
Oh, nice.
It's really pretty outside. How about taking me for a walk after you finish your breakfast?
Well, I suppose I ought to try to do some writing first.
Any ideas yet?
Lots of ideas. No good ones.
Well, something will come. It's just a matter of settling back into the habit of writing every day.
Yeah, that's all it is.
It's really nice up here, isn't it?
I love it. I really do. I've never been this happy or comfortable anywhere.
Yeah, it's amazing how fast you get used to such a big place. I tell you, when we first came up here, I thought it was kind of scary.
I fell in love with it right away. When I came up here for my interview, it was as though I'd been here before. I mean, we all have moments of deja vu, but this was ridiculous. It was almost as though I knew what was going to be around every corner.
Hello.
has to keep America clean. How's that?
All right.
And you're gonna lose. And I'm gonna get you. You better run fast. Look out. I'm coming in close.
All right. You have to keep America clean.
Oh, no.
Keep America clean.
Okay. Anna, you win. Let's take the rest of this walking, huh?
Okay.
Whew. Give me a hand. Oh, isn't it beautiful?
Yeah.
Day.
Rutherford was serving a life sentence for his conviction in a 1968 shooting. And the search continues in the mountains near Ouray today for that missing Aspen woman. 24-year-old Susan Robertson has been missing 10 days. She disappeared while on a hunting trip with her husband. They have good weather right now, but they may have to call off the search if a predicted snowstorm moves in tomorrow. Sunny, it's so beautiful here in Denver today, it's hard to believe a snowstorm could be that close.
I know. I want to go outside and lie in the sun, yet to our north, to our west, it is snowing and cold, and it's moving right here towards Colorado right now as we talk. It's incredible.
Thank you.
written today?
Yes.
Hey, the weather forecast said it's going to snow tonight.
What do you want me to do about it?
Oh, come on, hon. Don't be so grouchy.
It's my work.
Okay, I understand. I'll come back later on with a couple of sandwiches for you, and maybe you'll let me read something then.
Wendy, let me explain something to you. Whenever you come in here and interrupt me, you're breaking my concentration. You're distracting me, and it will then take me time to get back to where I was. Understand?
Yeah.
We're going to make a new rule. Whenever I'm in here, you hear me typing. Whether you don't hear me typing, whether the fuck you hear me doing in here, when I'm in here, that means that I am working. That means don't come in. How do you think you can handle that?
Yeah.
Fine. Why don't you start right now and get the fuck out of here?
This is KDK-12 calling KDK-1.
KDK-12 to KDK-1. This is KDK-1. We're receiving you. Over.
Hi, this is Wendy Torrance at the Overlook Hotel.
Hi, how are you folks getting on up there? Over.
Oh, we're just fine. But our telephones don't seem to be doing too well. Are the lines down by any chance? Over.
Yes, quite a few of them are down due to the storm. Over.
Any chance of them being repaired soon? Over.
Well, I wouldn't like to say. Most winters, they stay that way until spring. Over.
Boy, this storm is really something, isn't it? Over.
Oh, yes, it's one of the worst we've had for years. Is there anything else we can do for you, Mrs. Torrance? Over.
I suppose not. Over.
Well, if you folks have any problems up there, just give us a call. And Mrs. Torrance?
I think it might be a good idea if you leave your radio on all the time now. Over.
Okay, we'll do that. It was real nice talking to you. Bye. Over and out.
Mr. Halloran said, "It's just like pictures in a book, Danny. It isn't real."